You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
All right, hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you from Renton, Washington, the hometown of our special guest from today's pod. In honorable mention, USA Today All-American at Hazen High School, where his record for career scoring was later broken by Dominic Green. He played and served as an assistant coach at the University of Washington before moving into his current role as color analyst on the radio broadcast. We're thrilled to welcome to the Peltoncast the pride of Renton, Jason Hamilton.
Hey there. Hey, guys. How are you? Kevin, Tristan, it's been great to be with you guys tonight.
Doing well. Looking forward to the Pac-12 tournament this week, which we wanted to kind of preview with you. But first off, I think let's talk about kind of the Husky season in general and you know, how things have gone in the first year under Mike Hopkins. You've seen a couple of these transitions firsthand, transferring to UW during the second year of Bob Bender's tenure, and then as a radio analyst during Lorenzo Romar coming in to replace Bender. How would you kind of compare this first year under Hopkins to those transitions?
Oh, it's vastly different. I mean, obviously, the program, from a talent standpoint, I think was very different. When I came in, and not to knock myself or the group, but the Pac-10 at the time was one of the best conferences, if not the best conference in America. And there certainly was a talent shortage at the University of Washington when I was coming in. And, you know, typically how programs are built is, you know, year one, you kind of establish a foundation. Year two, you make some strides. And then hopefully in that third year, you're tournament bound. And, you know, that was very close to the case for Bob Bender and the coach, the team that I coached on as we went to the Sweet 16 in 98 and then lost in the first round in 99. And then obviously Lorenzo Romar coming over in 2002 and kind of was on that similar trajectory. And then you take Coach Hopkins in year one, having a 20-win season, which is just amazing. And, you know, very nearly getting an at-large bid for the NCAA tournament in year one and still have a very, very small outside shot to do that in year one as well, with a couple of wins and maybe having to win the Pac-12 tournament to get the automatic bid, but certainly just an amazing first year for Coach Hopkins.
It's been pretty interesting to watch. What do you think in Mike Hopkins' first year making the tournament would mean for the program as a whole?
Well, you fast forward nearly 2 years, right? Tristan, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, Kevin, where you go, listen, you expected after coming off a 9-22 year to approach 500. That would be the goal in year one, to, you know, get somewhere close to 500. Instead, you know, you're at 20 wins and knocking on the door. So I just look at this as moving the needle almost 2 years in advance. You get out on the road and you recruit. You're certainly talked about nationally. And on the West Coast, where you're doing most of your recruiting and having conversations with coaches and AU coaches. So I think that the timetable has shifted greatly, especially with a team that is losing two seniors, and those two seniors, you know, former walk-ons and guys that didn't play a lot. So you're returning everybody from this year, you know, barring transfers, et cetera. But, you know, the program is in great shape after year one.
I think you're right about the kind of the timeline being moved up. We started doing the thing kind of halfway through this year where it's like, oh, well, everybody's coming back. And it's like, oh, maybe this team might be tournament bound or might go into the season in like the top two or three spots in the Pac-12 next year. And I think this season that the Huskies are currently having is kind of what we expected to be looking forward to next season.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, when you're trying to build a foundation and a culture, you expect that there's going to be, you know, maybe not everybody's bought in year one. And I think what Coach Hopkins and the staff have been able to do is change the culture very quickly to be in a position where now all of a sudden, you know, instead of going 500, you know, you get a 20-win season under your belt and maybe some more. And now the expectation exponentially increases for year two. And I think, you know, the buildup and the anticipation, the fan support, all the engagement that goes with that, you know, that just puts you in a position to be, you know, really, really solid with recruits and ticket sales and all the things that, that go with trying to rebuild a culture and a program.
Yeah. Has there been anybody, especially any players who've really surprised you throughout this season?
Well, I think Noah Dickerson is a guy that, you know, played so well in the last 7 to 8 games, 10 games last season. And you knew that he's a double-double type threat. And then with the coaching change, there was all the conversation about potentially him transferring and, you know, would he be in a Husky uniform and you know, how would he take to the new coaching staff and the philosophy. And so I was a bit concerned about, you know, where he was going to be, you know, mentally, emotionally. But for him to come in and put the team on his back and really be the catalyst for them on the block. I don't want to say he surprised me, because that's not it from a performance standpoint, but from the sense that they really, really needed his production, and he was still able to deliver after, you know, potentially not even being on the team.
Percy Allen of the Seattle Times did a story last week asking various people to pick their MVP of this year's Husky team. And you went with Dickerson, right?
Yeah. You know, I was very, I guess careful might be the right way to describe it, because I think if you were to ask the question a little bit differently and say, you know, if you took one player off the roster, you know, how does that affect your team and who would that be that would have the most impact? And to me, that would be Noah. I just don't think they would have, you know, any sort of block presence. And that's not to take away from what Sam Timmons brings to the team, but a guy that's a double-double nearly nightly, and your only real low post threat, if you take him off the roster, you're completely perimeter oriented. So I think everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses. I think Matisse Thybulle from a defensive standpoint, Jalen Noel from, you know, a clutch free throw shooter and a guy that can get you and create his own shot in the last 5 minutes and score you some buckets. And even David Crisp, who, you know, isn't a traditional point guard, is certainly playing out of position. But when he plays right, when he's a distributor and not a shooter, you know, this team is very different. So they all have their components, but certainly Noah Dickerson's the guy that I would point to as the guy that's the most instrumental, especially offensively.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting how many different players you can make a case for this year. I mean, Crisp is the guy who kind of has been the most indispensable in terms of like actually being on the court the most, including all 50 minutes in the game at Oregon State earlier this year without, you know, a reliable, experienced backup point guard. I ended up going with Thybulle under the logic that, you know, when the Huskies have won this year, particularly in conference play, it's mostly been with their defense, and he is the linchpin of that defense. I was curious, how familiar coming into the season were you with the 2-3 zone that Mike Hopkins brought from Syracuse? And, you know, what kind of adjustments have you seen him make over the course of the year to kind of try to improve the ability to take away threes in that zone? Because it's something he's talked about, and certainly it shows up in the statistics, but I'm not sure I, as an outsider, could articulate what is different about it.
Yeah. Well, let me start with your first question. How familiar was I? I think, you know, having watched Jim Boeheim in Syracuse for years, you know, from the 80s when I was just starting to watch college basketball as a young kid and you know, certainly working on my game and hoping one day I'd play collegially, you know, I thought to myself coming in, this is going to be a replica of Syracuse's defense. And what we saw in the non-conference was Washington did play some man-to-man. So Coach Hopkins came in and said, you know, we're certainly going to be a 2-3 team, but we're not going to exclude man-to-man, you know, situationally. And we saw that. As we got out of the non-conference, the evolution of the 2-3 zone became a staple game in and game out. And I think the one thing about a traditional 2-3 is it's more about playing an area and, you know, how you pass people off from the demarcation lines of whose responsibility is it for the guys on the top of the zone to the wing, to the guys in the post, and how that zone shifts is very different than how Washington plays. And they're literally willing to give up the soft middle of the painted area around the free throw line, as long as they are closing out on shooters and taking away the three. And I think, you know, you guys know better than anybody, being more analytics driven about the percentages and playing the odds on that and saying, really today's basketball, especially at the collegiate level, does not have mid-range game. It does not have mid-range shooters. So, if you can take away layups and you can take away threes, you have a recipe for success. And I think that's the focus of Coach Hopkins' 2-3 zone.
Mm-hmm. Well, how have you seen kind of when teams do get hot from three against the Huskies? That hasn't happened necessarily a ton during conference play, but we saw it certainly with Oregon on Saturday. How does that kind of shift the zone and what does that open up for teams?
Well, I think where you see success playing against the 2-3 zone of Washington is a combination of a couple of things. It's teams that have really crisp ball movement. They pass it well and they don't allow the defense to smother an area or, just sit in that zone and take it away. Oregon did a great job of moving the ball crisply and making the extra pass. And then wide open shots obviously are a higher percentage than contested shots. And when teams are making those wide open shots, it puts a lot of pressure on that defense to have to make some adjustments. And those adjustments that you see for Washington, because they're not going back man, it's trying to scramble a little bit more. So if teams are making shots against Washington, you typically see Matisse Thybulles in foul trouble. I hate to say it like that, but there's breakdowns in the defense because of a shift in personnel, and sometimes that leads to easier wide open shots, and we've seen that at certain times throughout the course of the season. Or it's a combination of a great inside outside game or two veteran players like we see with Stanford and Reed Travis and Michael Humphrey, where they can play off each other in a high low. Or Utah that does the same thing on a high low, tends to give Washington a bit of trouble.
Yep.
Yeah, I thought Utah's ball movement a couple of weeks ago in that game at Heck Ed, I thought that was really impressive and kind of exposed the Huskies zone a little bit, where it felt like at the beginning of the second half they had wide open shooters kind of every possession.
Yeah, and it's that short corner sometimes when you play that soft part of the zone and you're able to get to the free throw line, and then all of a sudden you can make that diagonal pass or that quick pass to the short corner and play that way. That's one of the recipes for disaster for Washington, especially if you have guys that can shoot, one of the toughest shots in basketball, a 5 to 7 foot baseline short corner shot, or they're active enough that they can put it on the deck at the free throw line, create, an opportunity, whether it's a kick out or drive to the basket. That combination is very, very difficult to guard.
It's kind of interesting watching the zone, where it feels sometimes like there's almost nothing you can do to play more aggressively because you kind of need to be in that space. But this weekend against Oregon, it felt like when they're getting down to the 8-minute mark or so, they were starting to trap much more aggressively. And Oregon wasn't a team who passed necessarily as well as somebody like Utah. And I felt like that was particularly effective for the Huskies and helped them get back into that game. And I'm curious if that's something that we'll see more of going forward, or if we'll see them kind of push towards that full court press that they've run in a couple moments, which I'm not sure how effective it's been. But if we'll see, let's say, against Oregon State coming up this week, if they end up getting down, if they push to that to get the energy going.
Yeah, I'm actually anxious to see that as well, because when Washington, I don't want to say when they play chaotic, but certainly when they amp up the pressure in the 2-3 zone, their energy level on the offensive end increases as well. And sometimes you see that with teams where defense creates momentum on offense and everybody starts to be a little bit sparked. But in that comeback, it was the defense and the trapping and the turnovers and the forcing of tougher shots that gave Washington transition opportunities, and they fed off that energy and were able to make some shots. Now, the difference between what we saw against Oregon and what we're going to see Wednesday night against Oregon State in the first round of the Pac-12 tournament, it's a neutral game. It's a neutral site contest. So you're not feeding off the energy of the crowd. And Washington has been for all purposes, a good road team this year comparative to other years, but you just don't have that same momentum, that same energy. So they've got to create that momentum with their defense. And so, I look for them to be really, really active in that zone and trap out of it if they need to.
Yeah. I mean, spinning towards Oregon State, you know, it's a team that you'd figure would struggle against the zone because of the fact that over the course of the season, they've really struggled from the perimeter, 33.6% on threes over the course of the year. That has not been the case against UW, where they've, you know, Stephen Thompson in particular has seemed to really get it going. Have you seen them match up with this Oregon State, with this UW zone?
It's a horrible matchup for Washington. I don't know what it is about Oregon State and how they play, and what it is about Stephen Thompson Jr. that he just loves to play against Washington. He loves to hit big shots from that left wing, three-point extended shot. But it's crazy because, you know, you look at the statistics on paper and you say there's no way that Oregon State, the way that they shoot it from the perimeter and, you know, how they play and, you know, that they should beat Washington, but they're a good defensive team. They're long enough. They're athletic, sneaky athletic. And it's just one of those weird deals where the matchup between Washington and Oregon State is it's a coin toss, really. And so Washington's got to do a better job of guarding that 3-point line and then just not allowing, you know, Trace Tinkle to have his way, in the soft part of the zone and Drew Eubanks to play above the rim or get offensive rebounds, because offensive rebounds have been a huge part of Oregon State's success against the Huskies in the two games.
Yeah, I mean, how do you do that? Because obviously that's a known weakness of the zone. And even at Syracuse with, you know, a team that was very much built to play the zone, the best, longest athletes you could possibly get in that, still you see several years where they've been near the bottom of the country in defensive rebound rate. So what is it kind of you can do to make sure that you're boxing out despite the fact that you're playing an area and not a man?
Well, the one thing that's, you know, it's a great motivator, but you never like it to come to this, especially as a coach, is the idea that your season can end, right? This is a tournament game. So the fact that you can say, listen, fellas, five guys have to go get a body and block out. And if we don't do that, we're going home. And it's a real home at this point. You're leaving Vegas and your fate is the NIT. Or we can continue to play as hard as possible. Everybody is committed to their assignments. And we've got a chance to maybe run this table or get three wins or whatever it takes and maybe sneak in and at large. So you have that motivator as a coach, but you're right. I mean, you know, at this point in the season, you kind of are what you are. And if guys don't have the mentality to go find a body, you're just susceptible to offensive rebound.
And I'll be curious to see also what the personnel looks like for the Huskies in this game. You know, it seems like in the last couple of weeks, we've seen them turn a little bit more away from Sam Timmons. There are a couple possessions where it felt like against Oregon that, Hop had to put Timmons in on defense and it still didn't quite work, where he was just like, we need a defensive rebound. But we've seen much more Hamir Wright playing in kind of that four position, and he is able to spread the floor a little bit more. Still not a great shooter, but I think brings a lot more athleticism, but you do give up some of that offensive rebounding that you might have with Timmons on the court.
Yeah, it's a tough dilemma for Coach Hop with Hamir Wright and Sam Timmons, because they each provide something, but it really depends on how the game is going. And with Hamir right now, early in his career, the one thing that he's able to do when teams try to double Noah Dickerson is at least he's a threat when the ball is kicked back out to shoot it. Now, is he going to shoot it and make it? That's where his growth needs to be. But at least he gives the threat of putting it on the deck and being a, you know, more offensive minded than Sam, who is really just going to reverse the ball. That's all he's going to do when he catches it at the free throw line or at the top of the key. But defensively, sometimes you need the size and girth of Sam Timmons to be a rim protector and a rebounder. And Hamir Wright isn't quite as physical yet, but certainly has the leaping ability and long arm. So what you see a lot of times is situational substitutions, especially with Noah Dickerson. There's a lot of offense defense. And then when Coach Hop is trying to get a little more athletic and maybe change the landscape of the defense.
I'm also excited about potentially seeing more Naz Carter in this game. He kind of reminds me, and has been playing more throughout the end of the season, but the element that he brings of when he's driving to the paint, and you just get this moment where you're like, Naz is going to throw it down here or try to, no matter what the situation is, it can get the entire team to kind of perk up just a little bit. He reminds me, and I'm curious to know what you think about this comparison. He's a little bit like the basketball savant Ahmed.
That's interesting.
It's like every single time he touches the ball, something great happens. Why doesn't he get the ball more?
Yeah, I it's funny. He is so dynamic, but he's also sometimes out of control, right? He's that combination of a freshman that just can be so electric and light the world on fire. And then you kind of scratch your head of, you know, there's a man standing there, right? And he is certainly stationary, and you're still going to try to run through him, aren't you? And absolutely he is.
Right.
But he is fun to watch that way. And you know, as his game starts to evolve, you know, and he starts to add some elements to his game, he's going to be really fun to watch over the next few years.
Yeah, I think so. He's definitely been one of the most exciting parts, like revelations of this season. You mentioned earlier this game being kind of a coin toss in terms of the way that the two matchups with Oregon State have played out. And that's pretty much what the statistical projections suggest. KenPom.com has these two teams rated almost identically, which is kind of fascinating when you consider their respective RPI rankings and spots in the in Pac-12 records. If we look ahead of this game, even though it's a coin flip, What do you think of the matchup against USC, a team that the Huskies haven't seen since the first game of the conference season?
I actually love that. I would rather play USC than Oregon State any day of the week. And not because not because Oregon State is more talented and any of those reasons. It's because USC is more like Washington. They're going to allow you to be in the game, whereas I think a team like Oregon State can play their style. And, you know, they may not be talented enough to win, but they're going to play how they play. And if they get you, they get you. Whereas USC, especially with Benny Boatwright, you know, injured and, you know, the makeup of USC and how they play, it sets up a lot better for how Washington wants to defend. And everything about that matchup, you know, makes me smile versus having to grind through another rubber match with Oregon State. So, you know, if you're able to advance, even though USC is the 2 seed, I love that matchup, even though you haven't seen them since the first week of the conference play.
It's kind of crazy with the season where it's like, okay, we definitely don't want to see Utah. We don't want to see Stanford. We don't want to see Oregon State. But USC, Arizona State, Arizona. I'm like, okay, we can handle those.
Yeah, bring on Arizona.
isn't that the weirdest thing? Right? I mean, I would literally take, you know, throw Utah out of it, but you know, Arizona, Arizona State, USC, UCLA, I'd take any of those guys over even Colorado, who Washington beat twice. They instill more fear for me than any of those top four. You know, it's, you know, Colorado, Utah, Stanford, Oregon State, Oregon. It's just I've never seen anything like it where you literally don't want to play those middle teams, but you're absolutely fine with playing the upper echelon.
We've gone a bridge too far for me when we go to Colorado here. I'm willing to take on Colorado. I think one of the interesting things we're going to see here is that for the first time, obviously these are teams that have seen UW during the regular season in the Pac-12, but, you know, kind of the oddity of going up against an exclusively zone team in a tournament situation where you don't necessarily have as much time to prepare as you do, you know, even with a couple days in between games at the least during the regular season. Do you recall anything like that during your playing or coaching career where it was kind of like the awkwardness of trying to deal with the zone team after you've been playing a man-to-man team in a tournament situation?
Well, anytime you play against, whether it's zone or whether it's a team that presses and traps a lot or a team that has great size, anytime there's a different kind of variable that's thrown out that's, you know, less than traditional, it's always more difficult, right? It's always harder with less time to you know, recreate that in a shoot around or in a one day scenario where you try to impart on your team, hey, listen, we just got off playing a team that wants to play a track meet. They're going to try to score in the 80s versus a team that wants to take the air out of the ball and play in the low 60s. And they're going to play all 30 seconds of the shot clock. You know, that kind of difference or differentiators are always, always very, very difficult. And that's why I think sometimes the zone can be an equalizer in a tournament situation, even if you've already played these teams a couple of times, especially though, if you're playing in postseason, like the NCAA tournament, where teams haven't seen you, they haven't prepared for it, they don't understand the intricacies of this 2-3 versus regular 2-3s, it's very difficult to play against on short notice.
And that'll definitely be much more of a factor if the Huskies do advance past Oregon State, because Oregon State knows how to play against this zone.
Clearly.
But assuming that that happens, Jason, how many wins do you think the Huskies need to get in the Pac-12 tournament to sort of be comfortably in the NCAA tournament?
Comfortably? Whew, comfortably. That's a good word. I think they win the first two and they're right there. But boy, I mean, the only way I could say comfortably is they've got to win the whole thing. Then you just get the auto bid and you are in, but, it's anywhere from, it's anywhere from two to win the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I thought, like you mentioned earlier, long shot. And I tweeted today about how it seems like kind of the tone of the conversation about Husky's chances locally seems more negative than it is nationally. I observed this while I was watching CBS's broadcast today, and Jerry Palm had them in his first four out, which I couldn't believe. I was like, did he not see the Oregon game? Did he miss that? But I think two at this point probably doesn't seem like it's enough. I feel like if they get to the conference championship, then, you know, you'd feel pretty solid about at that point.
It's definitely a dangerous territory because obviously teams are going to have upsets in their conference tournaments and knock teams like the Huskies off the bubble. So it's a dangerous place to be in. I agree that they should win.
Yeah, that's the safest move.
Yeah, well, the part of the deal is unlike other conferences, and I know that, and I hope that people understand that it's not about where you finish in your conference, about who you play, when you play them, where you play them overall. And in saying that, you know, you beat Oregon State, what does that actually do for you? It doesn't do a ton. It's not like, you know, some of the conferences like, you know, the ACC or the Big 12 where those wins early in a conference tournament are, you know, good quad one, quad two type wins for you. So really that beating Oregon State doesn't necessarily help, even though it's a win, right? You have to get farther along in the tournament for those things to actually have impact. So just to say, oh, you got one win, that doesn't necessarily equate to anything if you beat a team like Oregon State.
Right. Yeah. I thought I was at the Pac-12 women's tournament earlier and attended Larry Scott, the commissioner of the Pac-12's press conference before that. And he had the most optimistic spin on the fact that like Arizona is the only team locked into the tournament in the Pac-12 at this point, which is, boy, it sure adds a lot of drama to the games next week in Las Vegas, huh?
Yeah. Who would have thought, you know, I mean, the Pac-12 is perennially one of the best conferences in America. It almost reminds me back in the year that Washington won the Pac-12 outright and was leapfrogged by Cal and didn't go to the NCAA tournament. It was for all those reasons. Now you have Arizona, obviously, and then everybody else is just kind of right there. Look at what's going on with Arizona State, a team that had arguably two of the best non-conference wins and has been, you know, less than stellar in Pac-12 play, but still has a resume that's worth looking at and is probably solidly in, but yet went 8-10 in the league. So who knows what to make of this conference and what to make of this tournament, because I think it's completely wide open.
Yep, which makes it interesting. All right, I wanted to close with something a little different. You tweeted a few weeks ago that you were at the Blazers game. I can't remember which one it was. I know I was there as well, actually. And mentioned in your tweet that you were a ball boy for the Sonics growing up. So I'm very curious, what years were you a ball boy, and do you have any good stories from that time?
Oh, gosh, of course. So just briefly, the Blazers-Utah game, it was on a Sunday night. I want to say it was whenever we played on the Oregon State road trip. Lost to Oregon State on that Saturday, and then the Blazers-Utah game was that Sunday. And it was my son, who was 14 years old, it was his first NBA game that he's ever been to, which is why I sent the tweet, just because it was just so amazing to me to think that, you know, by the time I was 14, I had probably seen, you know, 100 games in person by the time I was 14, and it was his first. So to get to your other part of your question, Yeah, I started my first year as a ball boy was 1986, and my first game actually was Dr. J's last game in Seattle.
Wow.
I'll never forget that. You know, he was on his farewell tour, and it was my first game as a ball boy in the Coliseum, and you know, just an unbelievable atmosphere to be around some of these guys that you've seen and you dreamed about playing in the NBA. I was 11 years old, and yeah, so I did that for 4 or 5 years, and saw some really good Sonic teams, some great Laker Sonic battles, some great Houston Sonic battles during the Western Conference Finals, and some of those great late 80s, early 90s teams, and just had an unbelievable experience as a young kid that shaped kind of my basketball future.
Yeah, that's really awesome. All right, well, we thank you so much for taking the time today, Jason. And in addition to hearing Jason alongside Tony Castricone on Como News Radio 1000 during this week's Pac-12 tournament and additional postseason play, you can also follow him on Twitter at Jason D. Hamilton. So thanks again for joining us.
Guys, had a great time. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.